Oh, well, I tell you what, it's all downhill after you announce an ARC project, right? Well, I'll tell you what, that's going to be a big job. If I can ask you to be praying for that, that's let me just tell you right up front. You know, there's a lot of work behind the scenes. Hey, look at that. There we have it. Let there be sound, right? There's a lot of work behind the scenes to get everything going, a lot of engineering work. For example, the state of Kentucky does not allow us to go out and build a great big huge boat with a door in it. No, they require 21 emergency exits. You see? See the things we have to work around? But, yeah, that's what's going on. But that's a big project. It's tentatively slated to open in 3 years. That's the tentative build time. But today we're going to talk about dinosaurs, dragons, and the Bible. This is a neat talk. I like to have fun with it. Do you guys like to have fun? Yeah, all right. Well, let's start off with a little bit of fun here. Pastor, is it biblical to say that people are basically good? Yes. At sinning. Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that, right? Here's another one. In the book of Job, God told Job to behold behemoth. And it was probably also a good idea to beware behemoth. You didn't want that to jump out in front of your car, did you? And my last one. Here's Jonah. When Adam and Eve disobeyed God, they were the ones who did the eating. When Jonah disobeyed God, you know, you got to feel sorry for Jonah, right? I mean, we're going to get to heaven. We're going to get to talk to Abraham and Moses and talk about their wonderful exploits. Then we're going to see Jonah. We're going to say, hey, Jonah, what'd that smell like anyway? You know, thanks for that question. But, you know, we're in a culture where people have actually been battling over dinosaurs and the Bible and questions like that for quite some time. In fact, kids are really being drilled with dinosaurs. As a kid, I love dinosaurs. And there's a lot of kids' books on dinosaurs, my first dinosaur board book, or Dr. Zeus. Well, there's more. There's more. You know, the list goes on and on, doesn't it? And you guys probably seen a lot of books on dinosaurs. You may have some of them. But let me ask you, do these books give a biblical view of dinosaurs? Do they actually step back and say, let's look at the Bible and look at dinosaurs? No, they don't do that. In fact, most of the time when you see these books, they say dinosaurs, and it's followed by something like 65 million years ago, and there's no God, and things like that. That's what we typically see, isn't it? What's happening is the world is using dinosaurs to draw people in to a secular worldview. When they say, hey, let's leave the Bible out of it, that's a secular worldview. That is a humanistic worldview to leave God out of it. Now, we never want to leave God out of it, do we? We want to see God promoted in every area of your lives, right? And so it's good to get back and see what the Bible says on this. Now, the world obviously doesn't teach a biblical view of dinosaurs. What does the world teach typically when it comes to dinosaurs? Do you ever stop to think about it? Here's a quote from a secular person. Look what they say here. Because birds are dinosaurs. Did you catch that? Because birds are dinosaurs. Here's what's happened. They've taken all the birds out of the classification system, and they now lump them under dinosauria or dinosaurs. Birds are now classed as dinosaurs. That'll make you think twice at KFC, won't it? Go get some Kentucky Fried Dinosaur, huh? Oh, but you see, this philosophy goes all the way back to an alleged Big Bang. Essentially, there was nothing. No time, no space, nothing at all. Something pops into existence from nothing, and it rapidly explodes or expands. They claim this happened anywhere from about 13 to 15 billion years ago. I think most people have settled between 13 and 14. Now, I've seen calculations that 8 billion, others over 30 billion. They're kind of in a number of places there. Well, as the story goes, you get the stars about 10 billion years ago, the sun about 5 billion. The earth would have been molten like lava, would have cooled off. We've gotten the first oceans about 3.8 billion years ago. Then through random processes, chemicals come together, form the first life, and it evolves further and further to where you see a bunch of dinosaurs on my head. Actually, those are lorikeets. They're a very pretty bird down in Australia. These are actually wild ones. We would feed them sugar water when we were down there, and they'd come down in droves, thousands, perhaps tens of thousands. They were just beautiful. But you see, this is the way the world is looking at dinosaurs. Many of you may have heard these types of accounts. They're thinking in terms of a Big Bang evolution, millions of years. Evolution, right? We're in England, right? I have to say it the right way. Got to say Babel instead of Babel and things like that, right? It won't be long. If I keep that up, I'm gonna sound just like I'm from over here, right? Well, you guys are probably thinking, boy, this American, boy, he's really just destroying the Queen's English, isn't he? Oh, well, get used to it because that's the accent we're going to have in heaven, right? Oh, no. Actually, that's what the people in England tell me. Get used to theirs, right? But you see, this is the way the world's looking at dinosaurs. Well, if we're going to look at dinosaurs, we need to know what the definition of a dinosaur is. There's an actual technical definition for a dinosaur. Now, there's a number of factors, but the primary factors are that it is a reptilian creature that has one of two hip structures so that it raises its body up off the ground. Now, there's some other factors involved, but those are the primary ones. And there's websites that define what an entire dinosaur is. Now, with that in mind, Would something like a Komodo dragon or a crocodile or an alligator, by definition, would it be a dinosaur? No, actually, it wouldn't be, because their hip structures are on the side, so their legs come out the side, and the body naturally rests on the ground. So by definition, they're not. Now, look at these other two that stand upright. By definition, are they a dinosaur? Yeah. Now, think of this definition with regards to something like, a flying reptile, like a Iguanodon or a pterodactyl. By definition, they're actually not classed as a dinosaur. Neither would something like a plesiosaur. Now, in a way sense, we sometimes lump these in with the dinosaurs, don't we? But this baby T-Rex or this sauropod, by definition, they are classed as dinosaurs. Well, let me ask you this question. This will make you think, too. Does the church teach the biblical view of dinosaurs? By and large, across the world, the United States, UK, places like that? No. What do most churches teach? Nothing. That's exactly right. You know, I grew up in church. We never, ever talked about dinosaurs. If we did, it was usually met with silence. Now, there are some churches that are teaching a good biblical view of dinosaurs. They're saying, hey, let's go back to the Bible. Let's see what the Bible says about dinosaurs. You know what? We're seeing some of those churches just growing like wildfire. You know, it's really neat. You guys are probably familiar with Chuck Smith, right? The founder of the Calvary Chapel movement. He came to the Creation Museum. We had a chance to chat with him. And, you know, he thoroughly loved looking at dinosaurs and talking about some of that. It was kind of neat to chat with him about some of this, to get back to the Bible. And, you know, that was a passion he had, was to get back to the Bible when we look at everything. And I love that about Chuck. What some churches actually teach things like this. These large and a few small reptile species appear to have dominated Earth's land and sea life from 250 to 65 million years ago. Their creation probably belongs to the fifth creation day. Here's another one. God made the reptiles, including dinosaurs, beginning about 230 million years ago. Well, here's what's happening. I would suggest that a lot of Christians are just taking the world's ideas and they're bringing it over and they're trying to mix it with their Christianity. Friends, should we do that? Should we just take the world's ideas and mix it with our Christianity? No, we shouldn't. We need to go back and start fresh and see what the Bible actually says on the subject, because when we do that, we're trying to mix two different religions. You see, there's a very popular religion out there that's really been popping up in the West. We see it in the U.S. We've seen it over here in the U.K. And that is the issue that where man is the ultimate authority versus God being the ultimate authority. See, things like creation and 6 days, fall, the flood, those are subsets to the religion of Christianity. But in the same way, when you see Big Bang, millions of years in evolution, these are subsets to the religion of humanism. Humanism, in its most basic form, is when man's ideas have been elevated to a position of being greater than God and his word. So when people say leave the Bible out of it, really they're raising up their own thoughts to be greater than God and his word. And there's a lot of forms of humanism. Many of you may have heard of some of these. Secular humanism, you may have heard that term. Or even atheism or agnosticism, new atheism. There's a lot of forms of it, naturalism, materialism. Even when people say they're not religious, that's a fancy way of saying you're a humanist because you've already denied God and his word as that ultimate position. But what gets me is when many Christians say, but we can take some of this, and we can bring it over and we can mix it with the Bible. Let's take, say, the millions of years of the Big Bang. Let's try to mix the two. But, you know, when you try to mix them, they don't mix, do they? You just can't mix two different religions like that. And usually what happens, people start giving up the Bible. You know, a day doesn't mean a day, or an evening and a morning, that doesn't mean evenings and mornings. Or maybe the sun was made on day one instead of day four, things like that. We start to see that popping up. But what I want to do is I want to get back to the Bible. Let's just start with what God has to say, and let's look at the issue of dinosaurs. Now, to do that, we need to know a little bit about the Bible. Now, do you guys all have the Bible memorized? Yeah, I don't either. We have people come to the Creation Museum that recite entire books. It's incredible to see. But what we've done at the Ministry of Answers in Genesis is we went back and said, okay, let's give some milestones throughout the Bible to give people a big picture look at what's going on in the Scripture from beginning to end. And what we have are called the seven C's of history. I know I said the word history now, I just scared you, right? Don't let it scare you. Simply milestones. Creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He created in 6 days. He rested on the seventh. It was a perfect creation. Deuteronomy 32:4. Every work of God is perfect. At the end of the creation week, God declared everything very good. It was perfect. Imagine a perfect world for a second. No death, no bloodshed, no suffering, no homework. Perfect world, right? Everything was perfect. That's what we expected from a perfect God. But when Adam and Eve sinned against God, everything changed. The world went from a perfect state to an imperfect state. See, God cursed the ground. He cursed the animals, sentenced man to die. That's why we need a Savior in the first place, isn't it? Because of sin, going all the way back to the very first sin. That's why we need a new heavens and a new earth. This one's cursed. This one's broken, you see. Then we see the catastrophe at the flood of Noah's day, which accounts for most of the rock layers. that contained fossils, things like that. Now, of course, we've had rock layers since then, volcanoes and local catastrophes. Then we can see there's the fourth C here, the confusion at the Tower of Babel. Babel. Just going to show the effects are still in, right? Well, then we have Christ stepping into history. And then we see his work on the cross, where the infinite Son took the infinite punishment from the infinite Father, and that satisfied the wrath of God. That canceled the debt. Yeah. The Lord offers a free gift of salvation. That's incredible. Only Christ could do that. And then we look forward to the final consummation, right? There'll be no more death, no more suffering, no more crying, no more tears, no more baldness, no more homework. At least those are the things I'm looking forward to, right? Oh, I'm losing my hair. Telling you. New heavens and a new earth. But we're going to use some of these seeds of history when we look at dinosaurs. And we're going to do this with a series of questions. And from time to time, we're going to see what the secular world has to say about that question and maybe do a little bit of a compare and contrast. Now, we're going to do this with a number of questions. You ready to jump into them? We got four excited people here. You guys ready to jump into these questions? There we go. What day did God make T-Rex? Let's think about this. T-Rex is a land animal, right? We've seen its footprints on lands. It seemed very well designed to be a land animal. If you jump back to the Bible, Genesis 1, verse 25, and God made the beasts of the earth, that includes dinosaurs, according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. This is part of day six of creation. See, land animals were made on day six. T-Rex is a land animal. So what day was T-Rex made? Day six. There you have it. You have an A in my class. You're doing great. All right. What do you think that T-Rex originally ate? Ah, I heard the right answer in here. But let's go through this just so everybody understands. Look at this T-Rex. Vicious, isn't it? Yeah, you don't want one of those on your doorstep, right? Wake up in the morning, grab the paper. Oh, there's a T-Rex. I better go back in. I mean, look at those vicious-looking teeth and those mean-looking claws. Well, not those. Those aren't that scary. What does he use those little arms for? I'm going to get you. Oh. You think that was on his menu? What about something like this? Yeah, let's see what the Bible says. Genesis 1, verse 30. Also, to every beast of the earth, that includes the dinosaurs, to every bird of the air, to everything that creeps on the earth and which shares life, I've given every green herb for food. So originally, that T-Rex was a vegetarian. Now, I've had people say, now, hold on a second. We've found some fossilized T-Rexes, and one of them eating a little juvenile protoceratops. We can see it fossilized in its stomach contents. One of them eating a little duck-billed dinosaur. So at some point, that T-Rex did start to eat meat. Can anybody name the event in Bible history that changed everything where sin and death came into the world? Yeah. The flood was significant. Yeah, we're getting to that one too. But children's books, right? You got to love them. I want to use this to dispel a myth. How many people have heard Adam and Eve ate an apple? You guys heard that one? I mean, I see that all the time. I have four kids, seven and under. We have a newborn. And then I was like, see ya, hon. Going to the UK for a couple of weeks. So she's not happy with me right now, so please be praying for my wife. But with the children's books here, we don't know what the fruit looked like. It was a real fruit, though, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But I love the way this is drawn. Doesn't that look like a hand grenade? Yeah, that changed everything. But I've had people ask a really good question. They said, okay, if the world was very good, perfect, no death, animals weren't eating other animals, why do we see all these design features that seem so well designed to go out and kill and eat other things? For example, the powerful jaw and the teeth on this alligator here. I actually took that picture. I'll never get that close again. What about the talons on an eagle? It seems so well designed to go down and grab a rabbit or a fish out of the sea. But then you see defensive structures like a turtle shell to help protect itself from getting eaten. And I've had people say, okay, if the world was very good and perfect, why do we need those? Where did those come from? Well, there's actually two biblical viewpoints on this. The first is that the original design was used to eat vegetarian foods, or basically used for a different purpose. I mean, imagine a T-Rex. They could have a heyday in a melon patch, couldn't we? Yeah. The whole melon patch is gone. Now, I've had people say, but Bodhi's got sharp teeth. That means it's a meat eater, right? No. Sharp teeth mean one thing. It means they have sharp teeth. Mm-hmm. See, there's a lot of animals that have sharp teeth that don't eat meat. Cats, for example, can have a diet that's almost 100% meat, and yet we've documented some cats that refuse to eat meat. One of them, all would eat was spaghetti. That rabbit out of here. I don't want my spaghetti. Pandas have very sharp teeth, but what do they eat? Yeah, they eat bamboo, that's right. Have you ever seen those really vicious-looking claws on a squirrel? Yeah. What do squirrels use those claws for? climbing trees, holding nuts, things like that. That's right. They're using it for a different purpose. Now, the other viewpoint is there may have been some design changes at the fall of man. In Genesis chapter 3, when man sinned against God, things changed. Remember that serpent? That serpent that was influenced by Satan, cursed is that serpent above the other animals. It's going to crawl on its belly and eat dust all the days of its life. Most commentators think that serpent physically changed forms to be at a lower position. On your belly you shall go and you shall eat dust. Well, do you think some of the other animals may have underwent some changes as well to maybe help them survive in a sin-cursed and broken world? It's possible. Look at the parallel things going on in Genesis chapter 3. To the woman, to Eve, pain and sorrows in childbearing. Ladies, is this true? Yes, my wife has given birth 4 times. You ladies are incredible. But see, this was a physical change, and it was passed along. What about to the man? Cursed is the ground because of man. Thorns and thistles came forth. There was a physical change going on to the vegetation. So, yes, things were changing at the fall of mankind. We are in a sin-cursed and broken world. Now, in a perfect world, could Adam have petted the skunks? Yeah, he probably could. I wonder how long it took him to figure out you don't do that anymore. Honey, you're sleeping on the couch tonight. Leave the beehives alone too. You see, they had to adjust to an imperfect and broken world. We're used to it, aren't we? We've grown up in it. We're living in it. It almost seems like the norm. It's tough for us to step back and imagine what a perfect world would really be like. But I would leave either of these options open. It might even be a combination of the two, depending on the circumstances. And I know there's variations in those models as well. Well, when I talk about dinosaurs, I always get this one. Were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? I heard a yes. Let's see what the Bible says. Genesis 6, verse 20. Of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, that includes dinosaurs, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, 2 of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. So yes, 2 of each of the dinosaur kinds would have been on board Noah's Ark. Now, as soon as I say that, I have people say, you got to be kidding me. How'd you fit them great big huge dinosaurs on that little bathtub ark? Now, of course, there's a couple of problems with this. First off, why would you take the great big huge dinosaurs on board Noah's Ark? It makes more sense you take the smaller ones. Do you realize the largest dinosaur egg that's ever been found is a T-Rex egg? It's a little bit bigger than a football, okay? Which means even the biggest dinosaurs were much smaller in the past. It makes more sense Noah took the smaller animals, not just of the dinosaurs, but of others as well. Less food, less space, less waste. Let's face it, those are all advantages on board the ark, aren't they? But the other thing about that is Noah's ark was huge. Huge. 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, its height 30 cubits. Now, it's got 3 decks here, too. Now, here's something that I realize. In the UK and in the US, we have to convert between a lot of our measurements. Now, you know one thing that I love? You guys actually use miles over here. That's brilliant. So that's an easy one for me. But neither one of us use cubits, do we? No. See, a cubit is actually from fingertip to elbow. And if we look out here, I look at some people's cubits. They're all a little bit different, aren't they? Usually the king that was in charge of an ancient culture, their cubit was usually the official cubit. So we have slightly variant cubits in these different cultures. Now the Bible lists 2 cubits. You have a shorter or a common cubit, and then you have a longer cubit, which was a cubit and a handbreadth. The shorter cubit was typically about 18 inches. Your longer between 20 and 21 inches. Now if we just use the shorter cubit, the 18-inch cubit, Noah's Ark would have had the same railroad stock car capacity as 522 of them. 22 railroad stock cars worth of space. That's an incredible amount, isn't it? Yeah. So I suggest we actually start using Noah's Ark actually more to the biblical proportions as opposed to say something like this. This is cute, yes, but what does this tell the kids of the next generation? It tells them it's just a myth, doesn't it? It's not real. It's like Shrek or Cinderella, things like that. I mean, there's no way something like this would survive a global flood. In fact, I would hate to be a giraffe. As soon as Noah gets cold, fires up the fireplace, those giraffes are toast. All over with. Well, how many different kinds of dinosaurs need to be on Noah's Ark? Well, 2 of each kind, that's right. But how many different kinds? People have estimated, actually I've seen different estimates, one from a paleontologist, one from a dinosaur sculptor, that both said about 50 different kinds of dinosaurs. Now, a kind is different from a species. You guys have all heard the term species, right? We throw the term species out there left and right. We find things and give it a new species name. But let's just look at dogs for an example. You guys like dogs? Good. All right. Got our dog lovers here. Well, when it comes to dogs, there's a lot of dog species. There's several wolf species, several coyote species, and dingoes. Domestic dogs are all classed as one species. But you know what? There's one dog kind. Noah only needed two dogs on board Noah's ark. All the dogs we have today are the descendants of those dogs. And yes, we see variation in amongst them, but all these dogs can ultimately interbreed with each other. So as one dog kind, Noah only needed two of them. It's the same sort of thing with our ceratopsians. Okay, we throw out all these different species names, Triceratops, Torosaurus, and so on, but these are just variations within the same ceratopsian kind of dinosaur. Noah only needed two of the ceratopsians on board Noah's ark. You take the smaller ones, juveniles, they would easily fit. Same thing with our sauropods. We throw out all these species names, Apatosaurus and Brachiosaur and things like that. They're just variations within the same sauropod kind of dinosaur. So if there's 50 kinds, that's only 100 individuals. Now, a lot of people don't realize that the average size of all the dinosaurs is about the size of a sheep or a dog. So a lot of them are actually quite small. It's the big ones that are famous, right? Our stegosaurs and triceratops and things like that. So yeah, they would easily fit on board Noah's Ark. Well, here's an easy question. What happened to the dinosaurs during the flood that were not on Noah's Ark? Come on. Mm-hmm. That's right. They died. They tried, but they died. And the Bible says they all died. Look at that. All the animals were on dry land, died. I have a picture of it. I'm telling you, kids' books are great, aren't they? But, you know, a lot of these dinosaurs probably rotted and decayed. Others were fleeing, trying to get to higher ground. And then you have the mud and the sediment and everything creeping up on everything. There's just nowhere else to go. And when you get rapidly buried, you're a candidate for fossilization. We find these huge dinosaur graveyards in various parts of the world, several of them in the United States. It's really neat to see how to go out there. But do you guys notice the tag on here? Here, let me zoom up. There you go. See, dinosaurs don't have tags say how old they are. You know, those bones are made out of things like limestone, so that it's not datable anyway. So where does the date for a dinosaur bone come from? Well, many of you may have seen something like this called a geological time scale. You see it in kids' books. You see it in journals. There's really technical ones. There's really simple ones, things like that. But here it is in a generalized form. Now, these rock layers are real rock layers. Creationists, evolutionists, they all agree on that. They're real rock layers. There really is a Cambrian rock layer. Named for that's the old Roman name for Wales was Cambria. Devonshire, England. Did I say that right? That's where the Devonian rock layer is named for. But in the secular world, they would say each of these rock layers are evidence of so many millions of years old because they've assumed that there is no global flood in the past. They assume there were no catastrophes back in the past and that these rock layers were laid down slowly and gradually over millions of years. And the dinosaur bones are typically found in these three rock layers, Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous. Now, here's where the actual date of a bone comes from. Let's say somebody finds a bone here, and they say, oh, let's go over here on our chart. It's, oh, so many millions of years old. Okay? Well, let's look at it a little further. Paleontologists are the ones who typically study the bones. If you go to the paleontologist, you say, hey, how old is this bone? They say, well, the rock layers we find in it are so many millions of years old. So then you say, well, let's go over to the geologists who study the rock layers, like your stratigraphers. And you say, hey, how old is this rock layer? And they say, well, the bones we find in it are so many millions of years old. Do you realize what that is? That's actually circular reasoning, but that's where that comes from. Now, thinking in terms of the Bible, there was a global flood that accounted for most of those rock layers. So consider, boom, flood sediment. Were the dinosaurs, those three layers, boom, flood sediment. And notice, the millions of years virtually vanishes in light of a global flood. Anybody who believes in an old earth does not believe in a global flood. Keep that in mind. You know, that's just one of those things that happen. But if the millions of years are gone, well, how old is the earth then? You know, I've had people ask that. Well, I think they gave us, what, 3 hours in here? Let's go ahead and start adding up those genealogies. Boy, we start adding up genealogies. You guys will never come back, right? Fact is, you'll probably fall asleep. If you're ever having trouble sleeping, don't take a pill. Don't count sheep. Book of Numbers. I'm telling you, it won't take long at all. But let's do a short estimate here. The earth was created on day one. Adam was created on day six. You have about 5 days in between there. Now, if you add up the genealogies from Adam to Abraham, and most people can do that. That's in Genesis 5 and Genesis chapter 11, and it gives the age of the father to the son and so on, how they lived. You tally all this up, you get down to Abraham here, it's about 2,000 years after creation. Now, most scholars, Christian or secular, they actually agree that Abraham lived about 2,000 years before Christ, which is about 4,000 years ago from today. So from a rough estimate, you get 6,000 years. And just about every chronologist that I've ever seen that's done a tally on this has arrived at numbers very similar to this. In fact, most cultures around the world had ages of the earth anywhere from about 5,000 to about 9,000 years just from their own histories until relatively recent times. Well, does the Bible talk about any dinosaurs? Can anybody tell me book and chapter? Job 40. That's the one that always pops up. Yeah. Look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now his strength is in his hips and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. Now, if you keep reading, this behemoth goes out into a flooding Jordan River and has no fear. It's in amongst the reeds, and the lotus trees hardly give it shade. This is a massive creature, the first or the chief of the ways of God. But here's what I like. I like verse 17. He moves his tail like a cedar. Now, have you ever seen a cedar tree move? I mean, here's some cedar trees. You know, if the wind is really blowing, it might kind of kink over just a little bit more here or less. But there are some Bible commentaries that footnote this. And they say, you know what, maybe this is an elephant or hippo. So I went to the Cincinnati Zoo there right nearby us. And we have some beautiful Asian elephants there. And there's a couple of spaces on the pen where you can look at the elephants. And everybody congregates where the elephants are looking and they're getting pictures of the ears and the tusks and stuff. I was on the backside taking pictures of the backside. So I'm back there like, yeah. They're looking at me like, what is he doing? But I got great pictures of the backsides of elephants here. But I want to see this tail move. And this tail would whip up here and try to hit bugs and insects, try to knock them off. It's just flopping around. It's moving like a weeping willow would move. Not at all the way a cedar would move. And I thought, well, what about a hippo? That thing hardly has a tail. You know, a tail that would move more like a cedar, something like this. I haven't been around to fit on the illustration. Does that work? No. What about this one? No. You know, a tail that would move more like a cedar sounds more like a creature, be more akin to something like a sauropod. Now, just to give you an idea, a brachiosaur in size comparison to an elephant or a hippo, which one would be the first or the chief of the ways of God when the Lord is speaking to Job here? Yeah, the bigger one makes much more sense. Well, you know, the very next chapter talks about a critter called Leviathan. Do you guys use the word critter? Yeah? Yeah, we use critter and warsh and crick, but that's a whole different discussion. But I'm going to read verses 18 through 21. Tell me what you think of when I read this. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. What does that make you think of? Yeah, like a fire-breathing dragon. Now, I've had people come and they say, okay, buddy, listen, this behemoth, this leviathan, they're simply mythological creatures, are not real. I thought, really? Because the Lord is speaking to Job in Job 38 through 41. He's basically putting Job in his place. And the Lord talks about a lion. Is that real? Yeah, raven, is that real? Yeah. Donkey, wild ox, ostrich, horse, locust, hawk, eagle, are they real? Why would the Lord suddenly switch to mythological creatures? That simply doesn't make any sense. Of course it was a real creature. But Bodhi, you trying to tell me the Lord makes some sort of creature to shoot out fire? The Lord would never make a creature that possibly shoot out fire. Let me introduce you to a bombardier beetle. This beetle lives in South America, and it shoots out two chemicals and ignite with each other. Basically catches on fire. This thing gets superheated. Dr. Andy McIntosh up here at Leeds University, a wonderful creationist, he actually is one of the lead researchers on this thing. Now, this bug literally sneaks up to other bugs and cooks its prey before it eats it. Now, I'm not a fan of bugs, but this has got to be the coolest bug on the whole planet. The spiders have been dethroned with this one. But, you know, the Bible talks about other creatures that shot fire. Isaiah talks about the fiery flying serpents. Okay? The books of Moses, Numbers and Deuteronomy, both talk about the fiery serpents. You know what? If the Lord could do this with a bug, could he do this with a leviathan and these serpents? Yeah, absolutely could. Well, why don't we find the word dinosaur in the Bible then? I mean, that would just settle it, right? Yeah, it wasn't around yet. Let's think about this, though. See, why don't we find the word dinosaur in the Bible? Early translations of the Bible into English were in the 1500s, 1600s. You know, you might think of Tyndale or the Geneva Bible in 1560. There was the Matthews, the bishops. People are fighting over them. And then we got the standardized version of the King James. Fact is, most translations, even today, one way or another, go back to the roots in the King James. But let's use that as our example here. The word dinosaur wasn't even invented until the year 1841. That's 230 years difference. So why was the word not in there? It wasn't invented yet. Yeah, it's like trying to find the word Facebook in the Bible. Or iPhone. It's not there. But is there another word that could have been used in the Bible that would have included things like dinosaurs? What about the word dragon? Do you realize that the word dragon is in the Old Testament 22 times in the King James? In the Geneva Bible, it's 24 times. There's actually two words that they translate as dragon, and they're both related type words. Just to give you an idea, it's not one spot. It's kind of all throughout the Bible here. Isn't that incredible? Let's take a look at some of these. Isaiah 27, verse 1. In that day, the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent. He shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. Here, Leviathan is called a dragon. Psalm 91, verse 13. Thou shalt tread upon the lion and the adder. The young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. See, this is a land dragon here. Oh, so Bode, are you trying to tell me dinosaurs and dragons are basically the same thing? Here's what I would suggest. I would suggest that all dinosaurs are dragons, but not all dragons are dinosaurs. Remember, when it comes to dinosaurs, it was a very specific definition of a particular type of land reptile. Okay? Now, dragon was more of an overarching term. That would have included things like crocodiles and serpentine creatures, as well as the flying reptiles, as well as the sea reptiles. So basically, all the dinosaurs would be dragons, but not all the dragons would be dinosaurs. A dinosaur could have rightly been called a dragon. And like I said, there's a lot of forms of dragons. It's more of an overarching term. Well, I decided to look something up because, you know, we've all heard dragons are myth, right? I mean, who hasn't heard that? So I decided to look it up because, you know, you see this in the Bible, you read old literature and historical accounts, and they all believe dragons to be real. And I thought, well, when did people say that dragons were first a myth? So I researched, late 1800s, people were still talking about dragons. They were saying they were very rare. In 1902, the Encyclopedia Britannica, talking about sea serpents, sea dragons, they said they're there, they're just very rare right now. And then in 1910, this is the first time that I found anybody say dragons were a myth. It was in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Somebody said that there were still a few dragons up in the Alps. And a guy went up there, he couldn't find them, and so he said, therefore, they're myth. So I guess the idea that they're dying out like everything else was too much to consider. I mean, some people even went against this for quite some time. The New Century Dictionary, 1948. Dragon, a huge serpent or snake, now rare. Do you realize in recent times that people started to say dragons are myths? Now, of course, we've seen the fanciful myths, you know, How to Train Your Dragon, so, you know, where people are coming up with all sorts of fantasy. We've got to watch out for that. Many of you may be familiar with St. George and the Dragon, right? Yeah, the patron saint of England. Let me tell you a little bit about St. George. St. George was a Roman soldier, and he was living about 300 AD. He was in North Africa. He came across a village, and there was this lady outside of it tied to a stake, and she was going to be killed. She's like, get out of here, flee for your life, a dragon's going to come eat me. Well, let me back up a little further. This pagan village was being terrorized by a dragon, and they didn't know what to do, so they cried out to their gods, oh, what do we do? Oh, we need to sacrifice to the dragon. Maybe that'll appease the gods. So they started taking a couple of sheep out and feeding it out the dragon. So the dragon kept getting bigger, and their sheep population kept going down. Well, after a while, they ran out of sheep. Well, this bigger dragon now started to terrorize the village again. They're like, oh, no, what do? Oh, we need to appease the gods. Maybe we should do human sacrifice. So they started to cast a lot to see who was going to get sacrificed. They started sacrificing some of their citizens. Well, one day, they cast a lot, and it fell on the king's daughter. The king didn't like that. He wanted somebody else to volunteer and take her position. Nobody volunteered for that one. So there's the princess tied to a stake when St. George came by. That dragon came out and he stabbed the dragon, but he didn't kill it. Instead, he took it back to the village and slayed it in front of everyone just to show him it was nothing but an animal. Well, St. George was a Christian and they let him preach Christianity. The way the account goes, the entire village gave their lives to the Lord. So you never know what your actions may lead to. But there you have it. St. George rescues the princess. I'm surprised Disney hasn't gotten a hold of this one yet. Give it time, right? But you see, in all across Europe, there are dragon legends and accounts and descriptions all over the place. Just in the UK alone, one historian pointed out that each of these towns or villages are associated with at least one dragon legend, if not more than one. In England, before the Norman conquest in 1066, the dragon was chief among the royal ensigns in war. Many of you may be familiar with the Bayeux Tapestry, which outlines the Normans when they came in and conquered England. And you can see all these animals on here, and this thing is huge. There's a lot of dragons on there. And some of those dragons actually look strikingly similar to dinosaurs. I was up in Leicester when I came in, and we went to Guild Hall, and they had a number of dragons right in there. You know, that was actually kind of one of the symbols for the city there, Leicester Cathedral. In fact, we were in Bath yesterday, and we saw a number of them in Bath Cathedral, which I thought was kind of fascinating. But many of you may be familiar with the flag of Wales. You can't miss that one, can you? Yeah, they still have a dragon on it. Well, the old Mercian flag in central England here, they had a dragon on theirs as well. The Royal Bavarian flag of southern Germany, they have a dragon on theirs too. I mean, we see these all over the place. This is just a small sampling. In China, there's a lot of dragon legends over in China. They claim they used to use dragons to pull the chariots of the emperors, that they used to breed dragons. Believe it or not, there's even cookbooks of the various parts of the dragon you cook up in different stews. In China, the dragon appears as a national symbol and the badge of the royal family. The dragon adorned the Chinese flag until the founding of the Republic of China in 1911. Now notice, their dragon's a little different. Most of the ones over in the Orient were more of a long, slender. There were no wings on any of those. The flag of Bhutan. Now this is more of a modern flag, but this flag and their national emblem here, which has dragons on it, they decided to put the dragons on it to represent the times of the dragon or the Druk. Back in their past. If you've ever been to a Chinese restaurant, you might have recognized the 12-year zodiac, the 12-year cycle that's represented by different animals, 11 real animals, and suddenly a dragon. You see, the Chinese clearly viewed the dragon as being a real creature. If you look at some ancient literature, and there's hosts of these, but Aelian, in his book on the nature of animals, writing about 220 AD, says, but according to accounts from Phrygia, that's basically where modern-day Turkey is today, there are dragons in Phrygia too, and these grow to a length of 60 feet. That's a lot of stakes, isn't it? Boy. Pliny, writing in Natural History, this is about 70 AD, he writes that Africa produces elephants, but it's India that produces the largest, as well as the dragon. You know, I mean, we see accounts like that over. I was down in South America, down in Peru. There's all sorts of dinosaur and dragon-type things on rocks, on textiles, pottery, you name it. Here was one at the Museum of the Nation for everyone to see, a beautiful dragon right there on some of the pottery. And it was fascinating because we'd have a guide and they would go through and they'd say, yeah, the people in ancient Peru, you know, like the Incas or the Nazca people and things like that, they would only draw things they saw. And you'd see different snakes and cats and birds and things like that. And then they would come to the dragon. They're like, I don't know what to say about that one. Keep going. It was pretty fascinating. Well, why don't we find dinosaurs today? Well, you know, the secular world, what did the secular world say dinosaurs evolved into? Birds, right? Yeah, that's right, pheasants flying around here. Now, friends, I have no idea what T-Rex used those little arms for, but flying wasn't one of them. But, you know, it doesn't stop the world because we see an awful lot of artist representations of dinosaurs with feathers, don't we? We see a lot of those, don't we? And they're everywhere. You see them at museums. You see them in books. There are whole books on feathered dinosaurs nowadays. But you know what? We've been looking for feathered dinosaurs, not just us, but some of the evolutionists out there are looking for them too, because we're not actually finding them. One of the leading evolutionists who's a bird expert is Dr. Alan Fiducia. Him and his coworkers, they can't find any. Dr. David Minton, who's the world's leading anatomist, he actually sums up Fiducia's research. Look what he says here. Fiducia and coworkers have presented a substantial body of evidence to support their view that there are, in fact, no known dinosaurs with feathers. Now, if you go out and look it up on the internet, here's the kind of things you're going to find. Okay? And you look over here and you say, oh, well, there's some stuff right along the backside of the neck, but boy, I don't know if I'm convinced that's feathers. And you look over here and you say, oh, Archaeopteryx, Microraptor, Confuciusornis. Well, you look at that and you're like, wow, those do have feathers. Look at this. Feathers. Oh, yeah, so clearly we do have dinosaurs with feathers, right? Nope. Those are birds. That's what Dr. Alan Fiducia is pointing out. The alleged dinosaurs with feathers on it are actually nothing but birds. He argues that Archaeopteryx here is nothing but a perching bird. He's saying those are not dinosaurs at all, they're just birds. Now, there's three ways to make a missing link. I want you to understand this. When you understand this, you can look at any alleged missing link on any field and kind of understand it. Here's the first way to make a missing link. You take birds and you try to make them look like dinosaurs in your artist representations. And that's what we're seeing. They're taking this bird and they try to make it look like a dinosaur. The second way is you take dinosaurs and you try to make them look like birds. So people look at this stuff right here along the backside and they say, ah, maybe that's proto feathers. Maybe that's the beginning of feathers. But you know what? There's a lot of reptiles out there that have things like this right along their backside. There's no reason to assume those are proto feathers, right? But if you zoom up here, I mean, you get in here, you start to see some stuff that almost looks fibrous in here. You start to say, but those fibers aren't those feathers, aren't those proto-feathers? No, they're simply collagen fibers. Now, I'm going to put probably the most techie quote up here of the whole talk, and this is by Dr. Alan Fiducia and some of his colleagues. They say, the fibers show a striking similarity to the structure and level of organization of dermal collagen. The proposal that these fibers are proto-feathers is dismissed. All right, now I just scared you with collagen and stuff like that, right? Let me break it down for you. Collagen is like the glue that holds your muscles and your skin and stuff together, okay? And let's say I died, and I start to rot and decay. You start to see some of those fibers in there. Well, then let's say I get rapidly buried and I turn into a fossil. Then somebody digs me up. Oh, we found Bodhi. Oh, he's got proto feathers. Look, Bodhi's turning into a bird. That's all it is. You're seeing elements of rotting and decaying flesh, essentially. Well, the third way to make a missing link is, well, to fake it. Let's be honest. How many people out there in the world follow things like the Ten Commandments? If they don't believe the Bible and they've thrown it out, why not lie? Why not cheat? Why not steal? You know, that's the culture we're starting to live in, right? We're starting to see that. One of the most popular fakes was one called Archaeoraptor, and this was published in National Geographic by Zhu Jing. And we have correspondence where he knew about this fake 3 months in advance. It had been pointed out to him, and he published it anyway. And he's been involved in a number of the other so-called feathered dinosaurs that have been coming out of China recently. But this was clearly a fake, and they spotted it. In fact, there are so many fakes now that people are writing technical papers on how to spot the fakes. You see, people are getting better at it. But we've never really found any dinosaurs with actual feathers on them. But how do you change a scale into a feather anyway? I mean, have you ever seen scale? Have you ever seen a snake skin? Yeah. I do not recommend grabbing the snake and taking the skin off. Let them do it themselves. They don't like that. But if you see those scales, they're all attached together here. But a feather grows different. It actually grows out of a follicle, okay? A hair grows out of a follicle. You know, have you ever pulled one of your hairs out? I used to do it as an example. I don't do it anymore. They're precious to me now. But usually you grow a hair back. Same sort of thing here with the feather. How do you change a scale into a feather? Because, see, we see a lot of skin imprints of dinosaurs. Here's one from a hadrosaur, for example. You can see the scales in there. How do you change a scale into a feather? I mean, it's simply impossible when you look at the details. Now, here was something that, you know, I'm kind of surprised they published it, but this came out, and I found it in the New Scientist. This was in March of 2012, just a couple years ago. And look at these. Beautiful fossilized feathers. Kids can look at that and they say fossilized feathers. But notice the caption here. The caption said they look like feathers. Now, why did they say they looked like feathers? You know what the conclusion of the paper was? That these are not true feathers. Now, remember those collagen fibers? They say those are true feathers, but they say these are not true feathers. Here's the reason they did this. These fossils were found in rock layers essentially before the dinosaurs. And so they said, uh-oh, well, these can't be true feathers because dinosaurs haven't evolved into birds yet. Well, but see, is this a problem? Birds were actually made on day 5. Dinosaurs were made on day 6. Birds were actually around first, according to the Bible. And to have these sorts of things buried in the flood, that's not a big deal, is it? I mean, we expect to find things like that. Well, here was another one that was published even more recently. This was in August of 2012. They found a theropod dinosaur that had eaten birds. Okay, just so you know, the theropod dinosaurs were the ones that went to the lineage of birds, supposedly. And yet, here they have it. And you can see the stomach contents in there. Let's zoom up. You can see in here. They can identify these bones from 3 birds. So how is it that dinosaurs evolved into birds when birds were already around being eaten by dinosaurs? Simply doesn't make too much sense. The more you look at the details, it's simply impossible. But to the world's defense, not everybody out there believes dinosaurs evolved into birds. You know what the second most popular view is? That something like a comet or an asteroid came in and struck the Earth and it killed all the dinosaurs. But what? Yeah, I know. The illustrations are great, aren't they? But essentially, why would it kill all the dinosaurs and nothing else? I mean, that's kind of a problem. I've seen some technical papers that said dinosaurs died of disease. Seen others that said they starved to death. Believe it or not, I've seen others that said they overate. And you will not believe the latest one. This one came out last year. Some of you might be chuckling already because you know where I'm going with this. But I have to put the headline up because you wouldn't believe me. Dinosaurs gassed themselves to extinction, British scientists say. And yes, it came right out of Britain here. What they said was dinosaurs gave off so much gas that it affected the climate, and that climate change then led to the demise of the dinosaurs. Well, the press was all over. They're like, dinosaurs tutored themselves to death? And well, I went to my artist. I said, hey, can you draw this one for me? And he's like, how am I supposed to draw that? So a kid came up to me after one of the lectures. He said, you draw it like this. I thought he's got to be a homeschooler. Oh, but really, is there a mystery why dinosaurs are dying out? The ultimate reason why dinosaurs are dying out is because of sin. When Adam and Eve sinned against God, the world was basically subject to the death and decay. We've seen all sorts of things go extinct. I mean, we've seen passenger pigeons, dodo birds. A lot of people think the West African rhino just recently went extinct. We have endangered species lists to help keep animals alive. Otherwise, we'd have had a host of them go extinct this past century. But the ultimate reason is because of sin. Now, some of the specific reasons might be that they have a changed environment. You know, most people believe that there was, or at least Christians, believe that there was an ice age that followed the flood of Noah's day, that was triggered by it. See, creationists and evolutionists, we both agree there was an ice age. They just have a whole bunch of them going back for eons of time. We have one significant one right after the flood. Now, with an ice age, about a third of the earth would have been almost frozen. How well do reptiles do in the cold? Not very well. It makes sense why their numbers were down. What about being hunted by man? Do you realize that most of those dragon legends ended with the dragon getting killed? Most of them were. But consider also, remember Nimrod in the Bible? You guys remember Nimrod? And Nimrod's something I used to think you call your brother. My older brother called me a Nimrod all the time. There he is in the Bible. Oh. Well, Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And there's a number of connotations with him, but could he have wiped out entire populations before they filled the earth of dinosaurs? It's possible. Diseases, yeah, we would leave that option open. Genetic problems, catastrophic events, things like that. We would definitely leave those particular options open. Now, are dinosaurs completely extinct? It's a good question, isn't it? For me to say yes, I'd have to look everywhere in the whole world at the exact same time. And friends, I'm not that good. I leave open some remote possibilities here in rainforests or things like that, but I don't have my hopes up unless somebody actually finds one. Well, is there any evidence that confirms man and dinosaurs live together besides the Bible? Actually, it's quite a bit. They're like cave drawings and etchings. These things are properly called petroglyphs. And here's one that's over at Havasupai Canyon. This is one of the side canyons off the Grand Canyon. I've actually been in there. And this creature looks surprisingly similar to an Edmontosaurus. Of course, there's other creatures and things out around it that we can readily identify. Here's one at Natural Bridges National Monument. And this creature looks surprisingly similar to a sauropod type of dinosaur. Of course, the Anasazi Native Americans had drawn several other things very similar. Around it. We have San Rafael Swell. This is more like a flying reptile. So by definition, it's not a dinosaur, but it looks very similar in there. We sometimes lump those in. Here's one over in Canada. This whole trip I've been saying up in Canada. I remember where I'm at. Over in Canada, right? But, a lot of dinosaurs had things along their backside. Think of a Kentrosaurus type of dinosaur. But you can even see a boat back here in the background on this one. This is one of my favorites. This was over at Northern Carlisle Cathedral in Northern England. And Bishop Bell, he died around the year 1500, and he's buried right in the church. You know, a lot of people are buried in churches. You go back and look at the old cathedrals and things like that. And there's a lot of animals etched in this brassing along the outside. And if you zoom up to it, you can identify most of those animals, and then you get to some that look, very similar to dinosaurs. I go down to Australia. Aborigines had this painted up of a creature they hunted that they called Yaru. And they know where to put those spears. But, of course, by definition, it's not classed as dinosaur. Again, license, we sometimes throw it in. This ancient temple over in Angkor in Cambodia was rediscovered in the jungles, and they have this relief out here. It's got several animals on that, and you can identify those animals. Then you get to this one that looks just like a stegosaur. That's incredible to think about. You go to the Ishtar Gate in Babylon, built by order of Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible. This is the eighth gate to Babylon. Back and forth on this gate going all the way up is this creature and an extinct type of cattle, an auroch. And if you look at this thing carefully, it's got a reptilian tongue, it's got scales, it's got a hip structure so that it raises its body up off the ground. By definition, that's a dinosaur right there. If you flip toward literature, John Calvin came out of the Reformation, and he wrote a commentary on the whole Bible. And this is the artwork from when it was translated from Latin to English for Genesis in the year 1578 here. And you can see a bird, a pig's head, and there's all sorts of little things on here. But this is what caught my eye. If I zoom up, you can see a couple of dragons right here along the top. And at the bottom middle, it's upside down, which usually signifies that it's dead. But this creature looks surprisingly similar to an ornithopod type of dinosaur. Ornithopods are one of the smaller ones. And at the Creation Museum, here we have one, just to kind of give you an idea of what it may have looked like. Gilgamesh killed a huge a reptile-like creature in a cedar forest. Its description is somewhat similar to that of a dinosaur. Beowulf, do you guys have to read Beowulf over here? Yeah, over in the States, they subject us to reading that Anglo-Saxon poem. it's a It's tough to read. Of course, there's modern translations where you can read it better, but Beowulf killed three dragons, Grendel, Grendel's mother, and then a fiery flying serpent at the end of his life where he got enough injury where he actually died himself. Beowulf did. But the description of Grendel is uncannily similar to a dinosaur we called Baryonyx. It was a big dragon-looking thing and had small arms but a big claw on it. And Beowulf was famous for ripping the whole arm off. Now, consider, Baryonyx literally means heavy claw because it's got this big heavy claw and a smaller arm. It's incredible when you see those descriptions. If we flip towards science, red blood cells, right? Now, if I were to cut myself and spill out red blood cells, would they last very long? Yeah, probably not at all. In fact, even in hospitals, it's tough for us to preserve them for long periods of time. They like to rot, decay, and get scavenged, things like that. Well, there were some researchers out west in the United States led by Dr. Mary Schweitzer, and they found this big T-Rex femur. And it was down in a ravine. And they got it all cleaned up. And, well, they couldn't get out of the ravine. So they thought, well, we can't leave it here. So they got a helicopter and they went in. And they tried to put that T-Rex femur on it. Well, it didn't fit. And so they decided to do something nobody had ever done before. They took that T-Rex femur and broke it in half. Took it back to the lab. And they zoomed up. And what'd they find? Look at this. Some preserved red blood cells. Now, these researchers were in shock. They were like, there is no way red blood cells could possibly last 65 million years. It's just impossible. There's no way. So they said, well, I guess red blood cells really do last 65 million years. Since then, Dr. Schweitzer and some of her team, they've cracked open some other T-Rexes here. Some of it had stretchy tissue. It gave off an odor. It was smelly. It was as if it's rotting. You see a vein in here. I know some other people who decided to crack open a triceratops horn. And they found some soft tissue as well. Some of it had some crystallized stuff right inside of that vein there. I mean, this is incredible to see. Now, does it make more sense that this is just a matter of thousands of years old as opposed to, say, 65 million years? Yeah, I'd say it does make a lot more sense, I'd suggest. Okay, let's review. That's a fancy way of saying you're going to have a test. Do you guys want to have a test? Yes, we have. All right, we're going to have a test then. He said it. That's right. All right. This one won't go on your grade report. But what day were dinosaurs created? Day 6, according to the Bible. What did they originally eat? Yeah, vegetables, vegetarian foods, things like that. Now, at some point in Bible history, all that changed because some animals did start to eat some of those dinosaurs. What event was that? Sin and the fall. That's exactly right. Now, whether some of these dinosaurs started to eat meat immediately or whether it was more gradual, we simply don't know. Now, did dinosaurs go on Noah's Ark? Yeah. What happened to the dinosaurs that didn't go on Noah's Ark? They died. Yeah, a lot of them rotted, decayed. Others were rapidly buried and became candidates for fossilization. Now, did dinosaurs come off of Noah's Ark? Yeah, and they're represented by a lot of those dragon legends and different pictographs and things like that. What's the ultimate reason, though, for why they're dying out? Because of sin. Can you name some of the specific reasons? Catastrophes? Disease? Changed environment? Did somebody say gas? Oh, boy. That's good enough. You answered enough of. Now, as a bonus question, can you tell me what century did people start digging up dinosaur bones in a great amount of detail? Does anybody remember? I thought I heard it. 1800s, 19th century? Yeah, I thought I heard it out there from someone. Yeah, and they called them dinosaur bones, which means terrifying or terrible lizard. Makes you wonder, would there be a controversy if we just called them dragon bones? Yeah, makes you wonder. But you see, well, how'd you do on the test? You guys do pretty good, you think? Yeah? You're lucky. When I have a lot of kids in here, I have the kids test the parents. And kids give out two grades, A, F. Good, bad. There's no curve, nothing in between. Either did good or bad. But you know what? We're in a culture today where people have been battling over dinosaurs. And it's because of two different worldviews, two different religions, and they're battling over these issues. Now, one of the things that I want to do is to get you to understand, hey, if we start with the Bible, it makes sense of dinosaurs. It makes sense of things like dragons, basically an old name that was used a number of years ago. Now, as a Christian, how can you use dinosaurs? Now, I'm assuming most people who come here are Christians, but there may be people who come through who are not Christians. If you're not a Christian, we welcome you here. We hope you're having a great time. But most of all, friends, we hope you're challenged, especially to consider the claims of Christ, because that's what this is all about. I'm not here just to talk about dinosaurs or creation, flood, things. I want to see people one to the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. I want you to realize a creationist can go to hell the same way as anybody else without the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. But as Christians, how can you use dinosaurs? Here's what I suggest. Use them as missionary lizards. You see? Yeah, that's right. Use dinosaurs to tell people about Jesus Christ. You see, that's what we do at the Creation Museum there in Northern Kentucky, just outside of Cincinnati. It's a world-class museum. You can spend 2 days there. All the tickets are 2 days now. We have a planetarium. We have a special effects theater. We have gardens. We have a rainforest that grows up every year, and we cut it off and cover it up. We have a petting zoo. It's incredible. It's a walk through of Bible history. And we have dinosaurs there. Here's an animatronic one. In fact, this was my daughter's favorite dinosaur, my oldest daughter. She used to run up here and just look at it and then move its head and eat. And she'd just look, she'd just stare at it. Well, we came in one time after hours because I could do that, you know. And we came in and all the lights were off and they turned the dinosaurs off. She ran up there and she looked up and it wasn't moving. She's like, "Daddy, shh." I'm like, "Why? What's wrong?" And she's like, "The dinosaur is sleeping." That was cute. Yeah, she was three. But, you know, we have a dinosaur dig site in there where we're pointing out we're all looking at the same dinosaurs. We're looking at the same evidence. We're looking at the same DNA. The difference is the interpretation of the evidence. We have a dinosaur den where you can go through and you can see a whole host of different dinosaurs. We have a giant T-Rex. It's incredible. We have dinosaurs throughout the museum. Here we have a dragon above the bookstore in the main hall. We have some little baby T-Rexes that are animatronic. It's incredible to see these things. And our sculptor has done an incredible job in doing this. But one of the things we're trying to do at the museum is we're trying to show people that, hey, the Bible's history is true on every subject, even when it talks about, say, dinosaurs and dragons. And because the Bible's history is true, guess what? The message of the gospel found in that same history is also true. So we can use that to point people to Jesus Christ. So what kind of resources can you get your hands on? Well, we actually brought quite a few that are kind of set up around in the room over here. But the first thing I suggest is our website, answersingenesis.org. This is one of the most popular Christian websites in the world. When you hop on there, you might as well bookmark it because you could spend millions of years on our website. Sorry, I had to throw that one out there. We also have a newsletter. Now, this is free. It comes out once a month. If you want to find out more about the ministry or get more involved, or if you have to have a speaker come to the area, it's a great time to connect with them. The fact is, you can even find out more about our art project. I mean, let's face it, this is an incredible project. And, you know, like I said, please be praying about that. I mean, years ago, before we announced that we were doing an ARC project, we were contacting lumber suppliers saying, "Hey, we need X amount of wood." And they're like, "How much wood?" I'm like, "Yeah, X amount." And they're like, "What are you building, Noah's Ark?" We're like, "Yeah, actually we are." So it was kind of neat to see the behind the scenes. Well, one of my favorite books on dinosaurs is called The Great Dinosaur Mystery Solved by Ken Ham. This was the book that actually really helped me start to say, oh, let's get back to the Bible and look at dinosaurs from a biblical viewpoint. Because years ago, I used to buy into things like some of the Big Bang ideas and some of the millions of years, particularly the progressive creation view. And this book really helped solidify me getting back saying, hey, let's start with the Word of God. It really does make sense of dinosaurs. We have a number of DVDs out here. For example, Jurassic Prank is one of my favorites. But my new favorite just came out this week. And it just arrived in the UK. Dinosaurs, Dragons, and the Bible. It was this talk. It was recorded, and we just now have it on DVD. So if you guys were interested in this, we've got a copy of them over here as well. I don't even have a slide for it. But all the DVDs out here, just so you know, are three for the price of two. So it's a really good deal we're trying to offer for you just for being here. We have a book called Dragons, Legends, and Lore of Dinosaurs. This is a book that I was involved in a couple of years ago. And this book, when it came out, it hit the top 200 children's books in America. And that's unheard of for a Christian book, so we were excited about it. But we did it as a family book. And if you go in here, you got the different folds out. It's got some of the petroglyphs and, you know, the different accounts from ancient literature, you know, the artwork, timelines, even, you know, where does the Bible say dragon? Where does it mention all that? We put all that together. So this is a really incredible book. We've got for the kids, and I would say for age groups, anywhere from about, say, age 6 up to, say, adult would actually really like this book. This is called Dinosaurs for Kids. You know how we have the 7 C's of history? We have the 7 F's of dinosaurs. We're just like a pastor. Everything starts with the same letter, right? We do the same thing. Formed, fearless, fallen, flood. It goes through that brilliant artwork, dinosaur facts and figures. Kids love this book. For the littler kids, I would suggest the book D is for Dinosaur. It's a flip book. I brought one just to kind of show you what it looks like. But it teaches kids the alphabet. You know, so you run through here, and it's got all the different rhymes. And if I can flip the page, you know, you go through here. You have the artwork as you go through, and you get up here to the dinosaurs. You know, kids love it. But notice on the back side here, you've got the notes on how to train this to your children. So it really is a wonderful book for the littler kids. We also have answers books for kids. These are actual questions that kids have asked us anywhere from about ages 5 all the way up to about 10 or 11. And one of them is on creation, the fall, flood and dinosaurs, God and the Bible, sin, salvation, and the Christian life. And we have 2 brand new ones. one on the Tower of Babel in Ice Age, and another on space and astronomy. For kids, anywhere from, say, ages 3 to 10, we have Dinosaurs, Genesis, and the Gospel. This is a 2-DVD part. Excellent with Ken Hammond, Buddy Davis. They have a lot of fun in front of the kids. It's filmed in front of kids, too. If you walk out of here with just a few books, I suggest it be the answers books. These answer the top questions in the creation-evolution debate. Where did Cain get his wife? What about racism? Why is there death and suffering in the world? What about dinosaurs? Why don't we find humans and dinosaurs buried together? Well, if there's a global flood today, what are the odds you and a lion are going to get buried together? Oh, there's a lion. I'm going to get buried with you. Sure, you have other things on your mind, right? But, how old is the Earth, for example? What about viruses, bacteria, Big Bang, millions of years? Those rock layers, where did the idea millions of years come from? Questions like that. And each of the chapters are a standalone. They were written at a layman level. So you should be able to go right to the chapter you need and read it. So it was a really good one. Now, that's three of the books. We have a brand new one out. And this should be the final volume. It completes the list of questions that we viewed were the top questions. It actually encompasses more than 100 questions here on creation evolution. Now, I did a chapter in this one on dragons, that history of when did people start thinking they were a myth, and looking at some of those different petroglyphs and accounts and things like that in history and flags and stuff like that. There's one on living fossils, cavemen. What are some of the best evidences? What about alleged transitional forms? What about distant starlight? That's a big one that keeps popping up. There's several different models. Speciation, climate change, image of God. You know what? The list goes on and on. And these books have been selling like hotcakes. In fact, the Answers books are the top-selling creation evolution books in the world. And if I remember right, they're selling all four of the Answers books together for £30. Is that right? I got it right. Fine. It's my last day here. I finally get it right. Take a look at that. For the first three volumes, we have DVDs where we as authors give you a short answer to a number of these. We've got Answers books for teens, volume 1 and 2. It takes a lot of the questions from the Answers books and gives it to them more short and concise for teens. Now, in volume 1, we decide to put a chapter we normally don't deal with, and that is the issue of sexuality. Let's face it, kids are being drilled with it, aren't they? They really are. Even preteens are being drilled with this sort of thing. I mean, you see it in TV, you see it on the internet, schools, peer pressure, you name it, it's all over the place. And I used to work with the youth, and the kids would come up and say, how close to that line can you get before it's a sin? I'd say, no, how pure can you be until you get married? You see, I found kids want to know the answer, so we put a chapter in here. Youth leaders and parents are using this as a guidebook with their kids to teach them tastefully what the Bible says about those subjects. So I want to encourage you to take a look at those. So I have a book on the fall of Satan, the fall of mankind. I've had 10-year-olds read that book, and they say they understand the gospel better than they ever had because they understood the fall so well. And there's a lot of connections between the fall and the gospel as well, which is kind of neat. I know it's a scary-looking book. How do we know the Bible's true? How could a loving God allow death and suffering? We have DVDs on death and suffering. Believe it or not, I have a whole talk called The Seven Seas of History. I go through the whole Bible in one talk. I talk fast enough, I can do that. But we hit those seven seas, we hit those milestones. And that's actually gone on to be a pretty popular DVD. I've got a book on the Tower of Babel, looking at the different people groups, where they went to, where did the English come from, where did the Chinese come from, things like that. Believe it or not, a lot of people's history actually go back to some of those sons or grandsons of Noah. It's really neat to study that. And of course, I have a DVD on the subject. The textbook for our ministry is one called The Lie Evolution, Why You Should Not Take Evolution in Millions of Years and Mix It with Your Christianity. Ken Ham originally wrote this book 25 years ago, and he recently updated it for the 25-year edition. The arguments didn't change. They were the same arguments. He just was able to add to it, and this is a powerful book. This is probably one of the most sold books in the creation movement as well. A couple things I do want to tell you about. We have a UK mega conference coming up in September. This is a big deal. Some of the all-stars are coming from all around the world right here to West Bromwich. And it's going to be September 4th through 6th. Just to give you an idea who some of them are, Ken Ham will be over from Answers in Genesis. John Mackay, who runs a big ministry down in Australia. We have Ray Comfort coming over. You guys familiar with Ray Comfort? Yeah, Ray's going to be over here for it. Paul Carner here in the UK. Brian Edwards, Dr. Andy McIntosh, and Dr. Stuart Burgess, they're all here from the UK. Well, so Steve Lloyd, they're all going to be here. Steve Ham's coming over from the United States. Friends, this is going to be an incredible conference. We've already got 300 people signed up to go to this conference, so that's exciting to see. Now, the last things that I want to tell you about, we have a bunch of little pocket guides for only £2. One's on dinosaurs. We've got some on just different other topics, the age of the earth, global flood, Noah's Ark, stuff like that. Here's another one that I grabbed on Noah's Ark. £2, it's nothing. And here are the others. Ken Ham and Bill Nye recently debated. Many of you may have no idea who Bill Nye is, but he is like a superstar over in the United States. He ran a science program for kids, and really what he would do, ended up teaching a lot of evolution. And he came out saying, well, you know what, if you teach creation to kids, well, that's like child abuse. Have you ever heard those types of terms? Yeah, well, one thing led to another, and they ended up debating Ken Ham and Bill Nye. Ken Ham did very well in this debate. And live, people watching this live on the internet was about 8 million people from 190 countries. So far, 15 million people have watched it and counting. And this debate, Ken gave the gospel three times in it. Now, that is incredible to be able to get the gospel out that many times. So, wonderful debate. Encourage you to take a look at it. We also have, and this is the last thing I'll tell you about, is a Henry Morris study Bible. For those of you who are not familiar with Henry Morris, back in 1962, with Dr. John Whitcomb, they published a book called The Genesis Flood, which triggered churches all over the world to say, hey, we got to get back to the Bible as the ultimate authority. Chuck Smith was good friends with some of these guys, like John Whitcomb and Henry Morris here. And I'll tell you what, this has gone on to be a powerful commentary because Henry Morris wrote a commentary on the whole Bible. And this is that work right here. Normally, this is a $40 book in the U.S., 25 pounds over here. We're going to blow them out to you for only 15 pounds. Now, I know a number of you are students, and you can't afford some of this stuff, but hey, we even take credit cards, so you can put it on your parents, right? Okay. But actually, what I would like to do, I would like to say a prayer. I'd like to pray for you guys, and I'd like to ask for you guys to be praying for me as well. You know, we do ministry all over the world. It's tough to be away from the family, but please be praying for us and the art project. But let me go ahead and pray for you at this point. Dear Heavenly Father, we just thank you and praise you for sending your son Jesus to die in our place. Lord, only Jesus, the Son of God, who is infinite, could take that infinite punishment we all deserved. And he satisfied that wrath. Lord, if there's somebody here who has not received you, Lord, I pray that you've been tugging on their hearts. Lord, I also just want to pray for everyone that's here. Guide them and bless them. Give them strength in today's culture to stand up for the authority of the Word of God and to share the gospel in many different facets of their life. And Lord, I pray that people are able to increase their faith and get questions answered. And Lord, I just pray also for some of these events coming up that the pastor was pointing out. It looks like they've got some big tasks ahead of them. Lord, I just pray that you watch over them and help them be smooth sailing on those things. But Lord, I just pray ever so much for your blessings. We thank you and praise you and hope you receive the honor and the glory in all this. In Jesus' name, amen. All right.
You have been listening to a teaching ministry of Calvary Southampton. For more information, go to www.calvarysoughton.co.uk.